Princeton Symposium West presents Session 12, Prelude to Claremont, Faithful Scholarship and the Mainstreaming of Mormon Studies, a presentation by John Charles Duffy with a response by Armand Moss.
Noisemakers, to turn them off right now. And welcome to, this is session 12, I believe, with John Charles Duffy will be our presenter, presenting his paper, Prelude to Claremont, Faithful Scholarship and the Mainstreaming of Mormon Studies. Little background on him, he's currently a master's, or currently working on his master's PhD in religious studies at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. Received his MA in English from the University of Utah, and has published extensively, appears in Sunstone, and has been a presenter at Sunstone. Armand Moss will be our respondent. He is a professor here, or at Claremont Graduate University, and is an author and of All Abraham's Children, Changing Mormon Conceptions of Race and Lineage, and The Angel in the Beehive, The Mormon Struggle with Assimilation. And we'll turn the time over to you.
I have a handout which Becca's going to pass around. Mormon studies may very soon take a decisive step into the academic mainstream. It has been suggested that an academic subject comes of age when it first attains the dignity of a university chair. If this is correct, then the effort to create an endowed chair in Mormon studies at the Claremont School of Religion is a key development in institutionalizing the study of Mormonism outside the Mormon world. Claremont is not the only institution of higher learning working to bring Mormon studies into the academic mainstream, but it is poised to go down in history as a first. Since the 1960s, Mormon studies has been pursued primarily by Mormon scholars speaking to Mormon audiences. Institutionalizing Mormon studies in non-Mormon venues such as Claremont means creating contact zones where Mormons and non-Mormons work together to develop new discourses about Mormonism. Various interests and agendas flow into these contact zones. For example, faculty and administrators at Claremont have their own reasons for pursuing Mormon studies, which may or may not coincide with the reasons that LDS scholars, donors, or church leaders might like to see a Mormon studies chair at Claremont. Mainstreaming Mormon studies is a process of negotiating among the various interests that flow into the contact zones. Scholars within the Mormon world bring a variety of assumptions and agendas to the study of Mormonism. Some of these have been more influential than others in shaping how Mormon studies is done in mainstream academic institutions. The most influential Mormon interests have been those associated with the term faithful scholarship, or cognate labels such as faithful history, believing history, the perspective of faith, and so on. I will define faithful scholarship more precisely in a few moments, but simply put, faithful scholarship is scholarship predicated on LDS orthodoxy. By orthodoxy, I mean affirmation of the historical reality of LDS faith claims, of the Church's exclusive claim to divine authority, and of the obedience owed to Church leaders. Orthodoxy encompasses a certain diversity of belief and practice, and its boundaries are not sharply defined. Nevertheless, orthodoxy has been enforced as normative within the LDS Church, which means that most LDS-identified people operate within its boundaries. Given that most Latter-day Saints are Orthodox, it perhaps comes as no surprise that faithful scholars and their supporters have been the dominant LDS players in the ongoing efforts to mainstream Mormon studies. However, faithful scholarship's dominance is not necessarily inevitable. It is rather the consequence of particular historical turns that hypothetically might have gone differently, and it is maintained in the present by Orthodox saints' strategic use of the rhetorical, political, and financial resources at their disposal. This is to say that Mormon studies, even at a non-LDS institution like Claremont, is shaped by intellectual political struggles internal to Mormonism. Furthermore, in a kind of feedback loop, the mainstreaming of Mormon studies influences the intellectual politics of Mormonism. In this presentation, I will offer a very quick overview of the history of how faithful scholarship came to be the dominant LDS influence in Mormon studies, and I will gesture to some consequences of that influence, both for the future of Mormon studies and for the future of faithful scholarship. First, let me offer a more concrete explanation of faithful scholarship. The term came into vogue in the late 1980s and 1990s to describe certain ways of uniting academic training with commitment to the LDS Church. Faithful scholarship does not name a clearly defined school or methodology, but it does point to an orientation or approach towards scholarship distinguished by the following characteristics. 1. Seeks to represent a distinctively LDS perspective. In practice, this means that it presupposes orthodox convictions such as the antiquity of the Book of Mormon. 2. Rejects the ideal of objectivity in scholarship, often on the authority of postmodern theorists. 3. Insists that Mormonism be understood in its own terms. Faithful scholars tend, for instance, to want to press the dilemma that Joseph Smith was either a prophet or a fraud. 4. Speaks of faith and scholarship as fundamentally harmonious. The import of this move is to assert the intellectual credibility of orthodoxy and the value of using scholarly tools to understand the faith. Faithful scholarship has come to be associated with particular institutions. BYU Studies and Farms both use faithful scholarship rhetoric in articulating their missions, as did the Smith Institute prior to its recent dissolution. Support for faithful scholarship also comes from BYU Religious Education, the Church and Family History Department, and LDS Public Affairs. Faithful scholarship is distinct from the New Mormon history, as this was described by Leonard Arrington and Thomas Alexander. In addition, it stands apart from scholarship published by Sunstone, Dialogue, or Signature Books of a kind that attracts labels such as liberal or revisionist. Sunstone and Dialogue occasionally publish works of faithful scholarship, but Orthodox scholars are likely to view Sunstone and Dialogue as unsafe forums in which to publish. The Mormon History Association remains open to scholarship from a variety of orientations, but is weighted toward faithful scholarship. Deciding who counts as a faithful scholar is tricky. Leonard Arrington and Eugene England would have insisted that they were faithful church members, but neither exemplify the faithful scholarship orientation I've outlined here. Both were too wedded to the ideal of objectivity, and they were too closely affiliated with Sunstone and Dialogue. For the most part, faithful scholars are those who affiliated during the 1990s or beyond with institutions that used faithful scholarship rhetoric to define their missions. By this criterion, the label applies to John Welch, Louis Midgley, Daniel Peterson, Noel Reynolds, Grant Underwood, Ron Esplin, Jill Durr, Richard Bushman, Richard Turley, and Robert Millett, among others. The label also applies to Terrell Givens. Other scholars have affinities with faithful scholars, but don't quite fit into the category themselves, perhaps because they evince tendencies that the Orthodox might see as liberal, or because they're simply not interested in working from an overtly LDS perspective. Such scholars include Philip Barlow, Kathleen Flake, and Armin Moss. Scholars who clearly stand outside faithful scholarship because their work is too revisionist in tenor or their religious views too heterodox include D. Michael Quinn, Claus Hansen, Newell Bringhurst, Margaret Toscano, and Thomas Murphy. The orientation that came to be called faithful scholarship gradually attained coherence between the 1960s and 1990s. During the 60s and 70s, Latter-day Saints in the fields of history, comparative religions, arts and letters, and psychology first started talking about making distinctively LDS contributions to their disciplines, one of the defining impulses of faithful scholarship. However, the most visible area of Mormon scholarship during that period, the New Mormon History, as it was usually called, was dominated by an orientation that represented the opposite of the four distinguishing characteristics for faithful scholarship I listed earlier. That orientation was articulated chiefly by Leonard Arrington and Thomas Alexander. Its distinguishing characteristics were as follows. 1. Sought common ground with non-LDS scholars. As Arrington once put it, to understand as scholars of any faith or no faith would understand. 2. Aspire to be objective, by which these scholars meant that they wanted to transcend pro- and anti-Mormon polemics. 3. Sidestepped questions about the truthfulness of supernatural claims and called the saints to give greater recognition to the human in their history. 4. Spoke of faith and scholarship as being in tension. These scholars expected to find conflict between denominational prejudice and events as they actually happened, to use terms that Arrington once used. The new Mormon history came under attack during the 1970s from instructors in the church educational system and a trio of apostles with strong anti-modernist and anti-intellectual sentiments, Ezra Taft Benson, Mark E. Peterson, and Boyke Packer. Packer's landmark 1981 address, "The Mantle is Far, Far Greater Than the Intellect," denounced the new Mormon history's quest for objectivity, its emphasis on the human, and its efforts to bracket off supernatural claims. In the 1980s, BYU political scientists Louis Midgley and David Bohn translated Packer's prescriptions into the language of philosophy. Invoking the authority of the anti-foundationalist turn then underway in the humanities, Midgley and Bohn blasted the new Mormon historians' pretenses of objectivity. They called on LDS historians to reject secular or positivist explanations and to write Mormon history in orthodox terms. Midgley and Bohn's attacks on the new Mormon history were one of several developments that polarized the LDS intellectual community during the 1980s. Another polarizing development was the scandal caused by the Hoffman forgeries. The controversy over how to understand documents like the Salamander Letter showed that some LDS scholars were more open than others to revising canonical accounts of Mormon history. Around the same time, junior apostles Neil A. Maxwell and Dallin H. Oaks encouraged scholars affiliated with the Smith Institute, religious education, and the rapidly up-and-coming farms to produce scholarship that would, in Maxwell's words, protect our flanks. For instance, by marshaling arguments in defense of the Book of Mormon's antiquity. Among the critics about whom Maxwell was concerned were Mormon revisionists such as George D. Smith and Brent Metcalf. The latter half of the 1980s saw a dramatic increase in writing by individuals, not all of them with academic credentials, who claimed LDS identities but challenged the historical authenticity of LDS scripture and the church's teachings about women's roles and homosexuality. At the beginning of the 1980s, the chief divide in Mormon intellectual politics was between the new Mormon history and the anti-modernism of CES. By the end of the 1980s, additional camps had emerged. To the left of the new Mormon historians, there were now vocal groups of revisionists, feminists, and gay advocates, the three great threats to the church famously denounced by Packer in 1993. Between the new Mormon history and the anti-modernism of CES were the anti-positivist arguments of Midgley and Bohn, and the work being produced, especially at farms, by the cohort Maxwell referred to as faithful Latter-day Saint scholars. This faithful scholarship, as it was coming to be called, differed from the new Mormon history in that it was overtly grounded in orthodox LDS presuppositions rather than seeking common ground with non-Mormon scholars. At the same time, faithful scholarship differed from the devotional study championed by CES because it engaged with mainstream disciplinary scholarship in ways that anti-intellectual voices in CES feared would undermine faith. In the course of the 1990s, faithful scholarship emerged as the dominant model for LDS scholars, marginalizing all rival orientations. Despite criticism from within CES, Farm's success at defending orthodoxy and winning a good name for the church through its contributions to Dead Sea Scrolls scholarship did much to convince church leaders and members of the value of faithful scholarship. The debate between anti-positivists and defenders of the new Mormon history ended after 1994, with the anti-positivists taking the last word. A succession of controversies in the early 1990s clarified and enforced the boundaries of orthodoxy in ways that placed revisionism beyond the pale. These included attacks by Farms on revisionist anthologies, the First Presidency Statement on Symposia, the exposure of the Strengthening Church Members Committee, and the September 6 excommunications. The stigma attached to Sunstone dialogue and signature books as a result of these controversies encouraged LDS scholars to do their work in venues connected to BYU, Farms, the Smith Institute, BYU Studies, thus enhancing those venues' importance as centers for Mormon scholarship. The normative force of faithful scholarship was further strengthened by BYU's academic freedom controversy, in the course of which faithful scholarship rhetoric was used to define the university's mission. Faithful scholarship's dominance over rival orientations was the result of intense contestation, including exchanges of insults, threats of lawsuits, attempts at censorship, excommunications, and the firings of BYU professors. By the time the dust settled in the late 1990s, scholars and institutions that had embraced faithful scholarship had achieved a status, and with that status, access to material resources and political clout surpassing that of any other camp on the Mormon intellectual landscape. That in turn put faithful scholars and their supporters in the position to make the most influential Mormon contributions to the mainstreaming of Mormon studies in the opening years of the 21st century. Faithful scholars have dominated the most high-profile Mormon studies conferences staged in mainstream venues, and Orthodox interests have directly or indirectly influenced the efforts to create Mormon studies chairs or programs. This influence operates through three means. One, institutions supporting faithful scholarship have put up much of the money and done much of the organizing work. The Smith Institute, Farms, and Religious Education were major funders of the 2003 conference at Yale. Representatives of those same organizations, plus the Church and Family History Department, presided over the Joseph Smith Symposium at the Library of Congress, while LDS Public Affairs provided half the funding for that symposium. Public Affairs has recently promoted faithful scholarship in response to controversy such as that over Lamanite DNA, and a representative of Public Affairs was instrumental in recruiting members for the council raising the fund for Claremont's Mormon Studies chair. Two, Orthodox Latter-day Saints who donate money to schools can influence how Mormonism is taught there, a point just recently underscored by Daniel Golden's Wall Street Journal article, which we were discussing in an earlier session today. Three, LDS politicians can bend discourse about Mormonism at public institutions along Orthodox lines. For example, fear that state legislators will withhold funding has made UVSC especially sensitive to LDS perceptions of its Mormon studies initiatives, in turn prompting organizers to curry favor with faithful scholars. Dennis Potter told a story about that also in an earlier session today. Claremont's interest in developing Mormon studies in relationship with the local LDS community, as well as with upper-level church leaders, with whom Dean Karen Torgerson met early in the process, has created an environment conducive to privileged influence for faithful scholarship. The LDS community with whom Claremont seeks to be in relationship is a predominantly Orthodox community. One sign of its orthodoxy is that this community's representatives do not regard Michael Quinn as a significant local resource for Mormon studies. Quinn's absence from Claremont's LDS Council or from the Mormon Studies conferences that Claremont has organized is striking and telling. Commenting on the role of donors in shaping Jewish studies, one authority has remarked that it would be naive to expect the wishes of the paymaster to have no effect whatever on the direction taken in academic research. It is too early to know what stipulations donors will successfully place on the hiring of the candidate to fill Claremont's chair. However, the Wall Street Journal's suggestion that the candidate may be required to have access to church archives has very interesting implications for academic freedom, since that stipulation would seem, in effect, to give the church veto power over the hiring of a candidate. The Mormon Studies conferences held at Claremont have sought to assure Orthodox saints that Mormon studies, as Claremont envisions it, will be safe. On the other hand, faithful scholars have not dominated those conference programs as thoroughly as they dominated the Library of Congress symposium or even the Yale conference, which had the greatest diversity of Mormon sponsors and participation of any of the Mormon Studies conferences thus far. In addition, Claremont's hosting of Sunstone West suggests an openness to multiple Mormon voices. Something similar can be said of the presence on Claremont's LDS Council of Robert Reese and Armin Moss, both of whom have strong ties to Sunstone and Dialogue, though at the same time it's noteworthy that Reese and Moss were among the last recruits to the council, and both are relatively conservative as Mormon liberals go. The bottom line is that while Claremont's vision for Mormon studies is in many ways congenial to faithful scholarship, Orthodox interests must negotiate with other kinds of imperatives that operate within the contact zone. For instance, the university's commitments to academic freedom and diversity. The negotiations required to take Mormon studies mainstream have had an arguably ironic effect on faithful scholarship itself. Looking for ways to meet on common ground with non-Mormon scholars, a number of faithful scholars have begun to make rhetorical moves that recall those for which the New Mormon historians were criticized during the 1980s. For those who may have heard it, Julian Reynolds' comments in an earlier session today exemplify this shift. Like the New Mormon historians, some faithful scholars now speak of the need to discuss Mormonism in terms other than those provided by canonical Mormon accounts, and they acknowledge the value of bracketing off the profit-fraud dilemma. In one of the most intriguing developments, LDS graduate student Stephen Taysom has championed what he calls a new faithful history, which he represents very much like Arrington or Alexander as occupying a neutral middle space between triumphalist and critical Mormon histories. Rhetoric about objectivity, in the style of the new Mormon historians, has also been invoked at times to define Mormon studies at UVSC and USU. The use of this rhetoric at those two schools represents a fairly self-conscious attempt to create an alternative to faithful scholarship. However, it appears that faithful scholars also increasingly recognize the usefulness of this rhetoric for securing spaces for Mormon studies in public institutions. The influence of Orthodox interests in the mainstreaming of Mormon studies is at this point an inevitable political reality. Like other minority groups, Latter-day Saints seek the validation that comes from being included in the university curriculum. In addition, they are concerned to see their movement represented in ways they find congenial, in academia as well as in other public arenas. Several of the recent conferences and other projects that have increased Mormon studies visibility would not have occurred without the support of institutions committed to faithful scholarship. And at public institutions where Mormon studies initiatives are not in the hands of faithful scholars, Orthodox Saints can still exercise indirect financial and political influence. It is unlikely that Claremont's chair in Mormon studies would have so quickly moved to becoming a reality if Claremont had not accommodated the concerns and tapped into the resources of Orthodox Latter-day Saints. On the other hand, Orthodox influence can raise uncomfortable questions. How will academic freedom be assured? Whose voices are excluded, and on what grounds? Where is the line between sympathetic scholarship and public relations or apologetics? Is it in fact possible for a Mormon studies program to maintain academic credibility and at the same time please a religious community with a history of rather aggressive boundary maintenance? How mainstream institutions negotiate their relationship to faithful scholarship and the interests it represents may be the central challenge for the future of Mormon studies at Claremont and elsewhere. At the same time, moving into mainstream venues requires faithful scholars to reconsider their agendas and renegotiate their relationship to the recent history of Mormon intellectual politics. It will, at the very least, be interesting to see how all this unfolds.
As I reviewed and listened to John Charles' paper, I find little to which I would take exception. We could quibble a little bit about how he characterizes the orientations and identities of faithful scholars or new Mormon history scholars, or those who, like myself, he puts in a kind of middle category, to which I have no objections, particularly in my case. But basically, I think he has described the historical and political contexts about right. I think it's understandable that scholars with the faithful image would be in the vanguard of those chosen to participate in the creation of Mormon studies programs at secular universities, at least those outside Utah. Academic leaders interested in such programs, such as our own Dean Torriason here at Claremont, would naturally start by contacting LDS institutional representatives rather than by contacting individual LDS academics. Approaching LDS public affairs or BYU or any other church institution would almost guarantee that the main players in the design of these Mormon studies programs, as well as those recruited to the endowed chairs, would be drawn from among the faithful. Even the university, for its part, recognizes the necessity, both politically and economically, of designing programs that will be respectful of the faith of the communities that they represent. This objective has been made explicit in the publicity at Claremont, not only where the Mormon Studies program is concerned, but also in the cases of the several other new programs now being developed in the School of Religion here, ranging from Roman Catholic and Muslim studies to Zoroastrian studies. John Charles concluded his observations with a series of unresolved and uncomfortable questions about how the academic integrity of programs in religious studies can be maintained in the face of the expectations and potential pressures from devout donors who are financing the foundations that support the endowed chairs and other aspects of the new programs, whether we are talking about Mormon studies or studies of any of the other specific religious traditions. In raising these questions, John Charles was, of course, concurring with the concerns expressed in the recent article in the Wall Street Journal to which he referred. As a member of the council which has negotiated the arrangements for the New Mormon Studies Foundation and Chair at Claremont, I am satisfied that the legitimate respective interests of both the church and the university have been carefully safeguarded. Without taking the time here to go into details, I will say only that I think the framework developed in this instance might well serve as a model for future negotiations between the academy and other religious communities. Now I'd like to offer an additional or alternative perspective on the money issue that has come up all day long today in discussing Mormon studies and who's paying for what. I am not worried about the academic integrity of religious studies programs at most universities, public or private. I certainly understand the references that have been made to the Utah situation, but I think the Utah situation must be understood as unique because of the political polarization that exists in Utah. But in most programs at most universities, I would not be worried about the academic integrity of religious studies programs. The campus guardians of academic integrity, whether they are self-appointed or institutional, have always proved amply alert to the encroachments of religious orthodoxy. Would that they were equally sensitive to the encroachments of various kinds of secular orthodoxies now rife on college and university campuses, as Larry Summers, who recently stepped down as president at Harvard, learned to his sorrow. Indeed, having spent most of my career at a public research university, I would say that I am far less concerned about the academic integrity of these religious studies programs and chairs, even when financed by the donations of the devout, than I am about the academic integrity of the secular programs now common on our campuses in fields such as ethnic studies, women's studies, and gay-lesbian studies, which are usually funded with public money and which enforce a more or less stringent political orthodoxy that is at least as hazardous to intellectual and academic integrity as anything likely to occur under the auspices of Mormon or other religious studies. In his description of the varieties that have developed in recent decades on the Mormon intellectual landscape, John Charles properly noted the polarization that occurred starting about 20 years ago between scholars sometimes labeled faithful and those labeled variously as revisionists, new Mormon history exponents, and the like, with a relatively small category of others somewhere in the middle. This is, of course, an oversimplification of the situation, but an acceptable one for purposes of this brief discussion. He also notes, however, and I think correctly, that during the past decade, mainly I would say during President Hinckley's administration, the polarization has been somewhat mitigated. The most strident voices from the two poles seem to have moderated or else disappeared, and some church leaders have begun to see the downside of sending ardent apologists in scholarly vestments to participate in such national conferences as those at Yale and the Library of Congress. I see signs of greater appreciation now, even in high ecclesiastical places, for LDS scholars who are willing and able to engage their non-Mormon counterparts in serious and sincere efforts to explore intellectual and theological differences without feeling the need always to bear their own testimonies. If I'm right about this, then the LDS scholars associated with the emerging Mormon studies programs will acquit themselves well in the contact zones, as John Charles calls them, where they can influence and be influenced by the ongoing dialogue with scholars of all faith traditions. Thank you.
Yeah, the question, repeating it for the tape, has to do with is it simply naive to imagine a world in which financial interests don't impact the way that the programs like this get run, and what's the alternative? I mean, what ought to be perhaps the boundaries or the norms for deciding what kind of influences are appropriate? Yeah, I mean, I alluded in the paper to a comment that Martin Goodman made in an introduction that he published recently on Jewish studies, where he made the comment that it is naive to think that the wishes of the paymaster are not going to have some kind of influence. That's inevitable. There are some people who have that more utopian vision. Jacob Neusner is also in the field of Jewish studies, has been very alarmed by what he sees as the impact of Jewish donors who are creating Jewish studies chairs, often with the expectation that the people who fill those chairs will serve the interests of the local Jewish community, particularly by encouraging Jewish students to maintain Jewish identities. Neusner hates that. And several years ago, he made some comment to the effect that it might be a good idea for universities to not rely on private funding as they're creating Jewish studies chairs. Is that realistic? I suspect not. I mean, the Jewish studies chairs that exist are overwhelmingly created by private funding. So in the case of Mormon studies, yeah, I mean, I think the bottom line that's emerging is that if there are going to be Mormon studies chairs, it will probably be because Mormons pay for them. And I confess I'm uncomfortable with that, which has to do with my own political situation vis-a-vis Mormonism. I don't like Mormon orthodoxy, and so I'm kind of, you know, irked to find that they are the dominant players, even though I understand the historical reasons why that's sort of inevitable. In terms of the limits, I don't know. I mean, I think that's what we're still trying to work out. I would argue quite passionately that the study of religion needs to be a secular endeavor. It should not be serving, overtly at least, the interests of religious communities. But that's not necessarily a popular position even within religious studies. There's a lot of sympathy within the field of religious studies for accommodating what are called insider perspectives, for doing as Claremont is doing, religious studies in ways that are perceived as being respectful of the religious communities. And I'm very ambivalent about all of that. I mean, yes, it all sounds very good and liberal tolerant, but what are the political implications? What does this mean for the way in which religious communities get to, because they're paying the piper, call the tune? I don't know. I have no answers to give.
Well, it is a dilemma, but again, I don't see why it's a dilemma that's unique to religious studies. I think it's a dilemma that is faced any time money that is produced and donated out of well-known auspices and private interests are accepted by the academy for producing courses or endowing chairs or anything else. I think you could even go so far as to say that some of the money that the University of Washington has accepted from Microsoft might be, a cause for concern. And nobody even bats an eye when you hear that the University of Washington has accepted millions of dollars from Bill Gates or from any number of other tycoons. And I think that the kinds of political interests that I spoke of halfway through my comments perhaps are worth reiterating. It's not only outside donors. It's their outside interests of all kinds, even if they are not donating money. If they have political clout, they have an impact on what happens in the university. They have an impact on the staffing of universities. They have an impact on the curriculum of the university. And political fads and fashions come and go on universities. And at a given point in time, it isn't difficult for the faculty of any university to identify which are the acceptable political positions for professors to take in their writing and in their classroom. Indeed, which are the favored positions or favored topics on which professors should seek grant money to cover the costs of their research? You just learn that as you go along. And each individual researcher and academic has to decide for him or herself where to draw the line on whose money you're going to take and what kind of research you're willing to do. I found it very disillusioning myself during the 30 years I was at Washington State University. Felt like I had basically wasted about 10 years of my life taking federal money to evaluate programs that were intended to prevent alcohol and drug abuse or to treat victims of alcohol and drug abuse. Because what I found out from my research was that none of them worked. And that however, didn't dim the enthusiasm of the proponents of those programs that continued to drag in all kinds of money to prevent or to treat. Those who, like myself, finally got sick of this and turned down the money were just considered suckers for not taking the money. And in my personal case, if you'll forgive the personal reference, it was a very salutary impact, because that was the point at which I decided I was going to bag all of that stuff and turn to Mormon studies totally from there on. So that was what I did. But my larger point, I hope, is not lost in all of this. That there is, it is not just religious studies or in general, or Mormon studies in particular. It's studies of any kind that are financed or are established by the political influence that is dominant in a given community or state at a given time. And that kind of pressure from any and all sources is something that academics have to fight and resist in any way that they can.
I would propose, if I may quickly before we go on to the questions, that there, I do see a difference, though, between this issue as it plays out in religious studies and really any other discipline. You're right. I mean, obviously, certain political and financial interests will be at work in research all the time. I think the difference, though, in religious studies is that religious influences, particularly at public universities, this isn't so relevant here at Claremont as a private institution, but it raises church-state issues. I was also intrigued by the analogy that you made in your comments between the influence of religious orthodoxies in religious studies programs and secular orthodoxies in things like ethnic studies or women's studies or gay-lesbian studies, which you saw as potentially more dangerous or as dangerous as the influence of orthodoxies, religious orthodoxies. I've probably gone as far as I want to do today in labeling Armand and his politics, so I will go ahead and now deflect what I'm going to say a little bit. I've heard this line before coming from George Marsden, who's someone that faithful scholars like to cite. He's a Calvinist historian who in the early 90s made arguments which were very influential in shaping BYU's academic freedom controversy and the ideas of BYU administrators about what a religious university needs to be. And he was very influential among conservatives and religious conservatives in arguing that, you know, we lived in a university that claimed to be tolerant, claimed to be neutral, but was in fact enforcing secular orthodoxies. I guess what I'm saying is when I hear that rhetoric, complaints about the influences of secular orthodoxies, it raises for me the question, to what degree does the appeal on behalf of bringing religious perspectives into scholarship serve very specific political, culturally political interests, as represented by someone like George Marsden? Again, it's to me, it's something of an open question. What do you do about it? I guess it depends on where you stand politically. Meanwhile, other questions?
Yeah. I guess it's you. Yeah.
Before you finish correcting the money.
Well, what would you assume that program would be like?
I assume it would be very orthodox. History will go by the wayside.
Well, then, what if somebody like Jan Shipps was to take that chair? Which is an... I don't know how you couldn't call her an Orthodox Mormon, but she'd be a credible candidate.
So would Dr. Quinn.
Dr.
Quinn.
Oh, well, sure. Well, but you know, Dr. Quinn has baggage as a Mormon that Jan doesn't have because she's never been a Mormon. So, you're right. Those things are never. I'm saying that the opposite of Orthodox Mormon, for purposes of who's going to hold that chair, the opposite of Orthodox Mormon is not something like unorthodox Mormon or renegade or any kind of opposite position you might take. There are any number of positions, intellectual positions, between orthodox and apostate or orthodox and non-Mormon that would be acceptable. And it may well be, in fact, it probably will be, that when we first start out here, that the person who occupies that chair will come from among those that John Charles has characterized as Orthodox Mormon. But even if that's the case, I don't think anybody would object, for example, if that person were somebody like Richard Bushman. And again, even if that's the case, it doesn't mean that the very next person who occupied that chair would be in exactly the same place intellectually. And I think there's room where, when John Charles talks about this meeting ground, what did you call it?
Contact zone.
Contact zone. That's a nice phrase. When he talks about this contact zone, where LDS scholars and others meet, even Orthodox LDS scholars meet with others, I think he's talking about a zone that has a real influence on the nature and delivery of the program that finally develops under the rubric of Mormon studies. I don't think there's reason to assume at all that that the most orthodox I was going to say camp, but you don't like the word camp here.
I put it in quotes.
Yeah. I don't think there's any reason to assume that the most orthodox camp of LDS scholars is always and in every way. Well, I think it depends entirely on what kind of feminist theology you're talking about. There's, as I read it, there's more than one kind of feminist theology. And as I read, for example, the work of Marie Cornwall at BYU, who I think certainly considers herself a feminist, she's a sociologist, which is not the discipline most likely to be chosen for that chair anyway. But as I know her and her work, other than that disciplinary qualification, I think she definitely would be would fit.
Notice that it does come down to ideology and not academic.
Well, okay.
What kind of feminist are
you? All right. Well, so suppose it was the Martin Luther King chair of some kind at some university, and one of the really highly qualified and recognized black scholars, black studies scholars like Thomas Sowell or McWhorter, were to be considered for that chair. I think his chances would be zero to none, for some of the same reasons that you suspect these. So, you know, it really gets down to this, doesn't it? Do you have a, going in, do you have some sort of conception of what would constitute the pure academic ideal that would have to be kept in mind and trump everything else in the selection of people for these chairs and these programs? If you can define that, then maybe we can talk about who would be in and who would be out. But you see, once you get that defined, I think you're back to the argument I was making earlier. There are all kinds of other kinds of orthodoxies that would corrupt or challenge that pure academic ideal. And so, you know, you...
Yeah.
So, you know, it eventually gets down to cases. And sooner or later, somebody is going to be selected as the first person for this new chair of Mormon Studies. And then we'll see how it goes. Certainly, if a candidate for the Mormon Studies chair here has, through his earlier public work or public statements or hers, put him or herself in a position in which he or she would be generally considered an enemy of the church, I'm pretty sure that person wouldn't get access to the archives of the church. But as from my experience in the last two or three years especially, access to the church archives is really fairly generous. I think you have to do something pretty outrageous to be denied access. And in fact, I think it was a Wall Street Journal article that reported that Mike Quinn still had access to the archives. I don't know if that's right or not.
That is correct.
Yeah. And so I think it's a mistake to assume that you have to be super orthodox to get access to the church archives. I've never had any trouble. Of course, I haven't tried to get Joseph Smith's love letters to Fanny either. But I was able to get a hold of some fairly sensitive stuff. I thought about the work of mission presidents among Jews in New York City, for example. I think a person is going to have to be pretty extreme in the other direction from orthodoxy in order to find himself denied access to the archives of the church. But you're right. Access to those archives will be crucial to the ongoing work of any scholar who takes such a chair.
I'm just curious.
I'm not sure that that it is the case that only a historian is being considered. I think the historians have been the ones so far that we have seen the most of, but Givens, who was out here, for example, is not a historian. I think we're talking not about historians particularly, but in a broader sense, people in the humanities fields more generally, which would include history and religion, religious studies, literature. Yeah, yeah. Probably not a social scientist, but maybe later.
Tim's a Mormon, right?
Right. That's a big problem.
I guess that got back to my question a session or so ago as far as the hireability of people doing Mormon studies. You have to find these Mormon studies chairs, otherwise you're basically screwed.
Well, I think to some extent, if you'll forgive another personal reference, I think my own career is somewhat representative of the kind of problem. I was hired to do sociological research in a couple of different fields, but one of them wasn't religion. It was understood that I liked to do research in religion, and I was informed that if I did this other stuff, I'd be tolerated to do work in religion. And so that was fine. And what I did over the passage of time was gradually phased the other stuff out and phased the religion in. I did a lot of research and writing and publishing in the sociology of religion generally before I got into Mormon studies in particular. And that was okay because as long as it's published in respectable academic journals, even if it's religion, why, you know, you can do it. So that's the tactic that an academic has to use. And so what you do is when you're new in the business, you kind of do what's expected as long as you have to until you get tenure and your last promotion, and then you go off and do what you really care about. And so that's what I had to do. But I think that's the situation you face.
But the question you're asking, I think, highlights the importance, the political and strategic importance of the endowed chairs. Because to the degree that endowed chairs get created, either at Claremont, either at USU, or elsewhere, the people who hold those chairs will be in a really wonderful position to be doing work related to Mormonism. Right? If I'm somewhere in a position teaching American religious history, you know, I have to face the kinds of concerns that Armin was just talking about. It's a constraint on my abilities maybe to do what I really want to do. But someone in a Mormon studies chair suddenly is in a position to be productive, and they're in a position to be visible. They're in a really powerful position to shape the field, to shape graduate students, which is why there's so much political importance attached to key players wanting to make sure who is or is not occupying those chairs. I mean, I suppose the lesson that comes out of this is that, if it's politics, and if you're unhappy that the politics at Claremont are such that Mike Quinn can't hold this chair, well then, organize. Find people with deep pockets. I mean, we're seeing how it's done at Claremont. Find someone who will donate, who will fund a chair. Find a college willing to do it. Try to create the stipulations that will let Mike Quinn take the job. I mean, that's what it boils down to.
I, at that juncture, I feel obliged to say that although finding people with deep pockets is an ardent aspiration and desire of the Council on Mormon Studies here, it is far from a reality. Nobody should leave this room thinking that all the money has been raised for that endowed chair. We have a long way to go, so we're looking for help.
Noel?
Yeah, I just had a comment and a question. I countervailing pressure. Do you see that as a problem?
Oh yeah, yeah. It's not just the question of private money. It's the question of any money that can be allocated either by politicians or anybody else for any particular objective. So there's no reason to be especially scared of private money, doesn't seem to me.
But as the public money is maybe more, there's more destitute, staring things.
Well, where religion is concerned, it's almost impossible to get public money. And so that's why your earlier observation, I think, is so important, that private money in the area of religious studies is really especially important. You can get public money in the sense that even many state universities will put money in the budget for a generic religious studies program. You know, that was a fight that had to be fought over a long time. But I think we're at the point now nationwide where even public universities can be persuaded to put money in the budget for religious studies programs. In fact, at the University of Cal Santa Barbara, you have one of the major religious studies departments in the whole country. Getting a whatever studies department for something more specific like Mormon studies or Jewish studies, that does raise questions of separating church and state, or at least the funds coming from church
so
versus state.
Essentially completely privately funded at public institution, in other words.
Yeah. I can't imagine a public institution in the United States allocating any public money for Catholic studies, Jewish studies, Mormon studies, or any of those other studies. In contrast to Canada, for example, because the separation of church-state is interpreted differently in the United States from the way it is in Canada. Basically, our philosophy in the United States is because we want to keep them separate, you don't give any public money to any denomination or any religion. In Canada, the philosophy is, well, you give a little something to everybody. And so the philosophy is implemented differently. But in this country, I think...
Yeah, they don't have a strong tradition of separation of church and state up there.
Well, yeah, they do, but they distinguish separation from a kind of equal treatment.
An example of how key private money is, I know that USU is being very clear about, you know, obtaining private money for the Arrington chair, because they don't want the person who holds that chair to ever have to give an account of him or herself to the state legislature. And certainly at UVSC, I mean, if they had private funds they could rely on, that would take a lot of pressure off them in terms of, like, legislators cutting off funds.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.